We believe that alcoholism is a disease and that Alcoholics Anonymous is one solution to that disease. I'm here to bring you the voices of its members. Everyone that comes on the show, including myself, is an active member and has found recovery in the rooms of AA. As you listen, please take what works for you and leave the rest.
Hi, my name is Jared, and I'm an alcoholic. I have a sobriety date of September 5th, 2016. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor, and I've actively worked the steps with my sponsor every day. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. It's usually the formula that I go with, because I've been taught that way, and I've done it that way ever since I've been taught that way, and had a lot of practice to do so. So I'll tell you a little bit about my story. I was born into a marriage that was failing, and they tried to save their marriage by having a child, and then I was born. I was born, you know, wanted, but the marriage failed, so my parents divorced. I was 1 year old when they divorced. I'm from the East. I'm from the Midwest. And, you know, when I was born in Ohio, and then when my parents divorced, they both moved. So I went with my mom and we moved to Virginia. We moved to Manassas, Virginia, which is right outside of Washington, D.C. And my dad moved to Atlanta, Georgia. And I was split. And I was split between time, between families. Both my dad and my mom remarried shortly after the divorce. And so then I had a bunch of step siblings. And my mom, she married another man. And they were, you know, I grew up in a more so, well, it's been deemed a cult by the Catholic Church. But I didn't realize that it was a cult. It was a non-denominational Christian organization, and my parents were ministers. My father was a minister, my mother was a minister, and my dad's new wife was a minister as well. And so they got basically stationed, if you will. They got sent on assignment to different cities to spread the word of God to the way over the world, they used to call it. And so they would lead fellowships. And so I was introduced to God at a very young age. And my spiritual education began at a very young age. I didn't know what I didn't know back then. It was like totally normal to be moving around all the time. Moved almost every year. So I actually did the count one time. I went to 17 schools in 18 years, my first 18 years of life. So some of those school years, I would move twice in one school year. And I ended up in Allentown, Pennsylvania. My sister was born. And a few years after that, my mom and stepdad divorced, about 8 years old. And my dad moved to Harrisburg, Virginia, which is middle of Pennsylvania. And my mom moved to Michigan after the divorce and took my sister with her and gave me to my father. And at that time, that was the best decision that they could make for me. And that's what I wanted. And that's what I would have wanted. And so, you know, I always had this feeling of unease because I was never really settled as a child. I became this chameleon, you know, trying to fit in all the time and naturally, right? Because I was always moving. I was always having to change. I was always having to change my environment. And I always wanted to escape what was in front of me. I was always very artistic and, you know, pretty outgoing as a child, even though my living situations and it wasn't perfect. I had a pretty good childhood and I was pretty happy for the most part. I got to about 12 years old and we moved back to my dad's hometown where I was born in Cleveland, Ohio. And I'm about 12 years old and that's when I started smoking cigarettes. And my first drug was nicotine. my first drug, my first, out of everything that I did, which was a lot of different things, my first addiction was nicotine. I remember I wanted to be a part of, I wanted to feel like I was one of the cool people. I wanted to be like my dad. My dad was my hero. And he was a heavy smoker, and he was back then pretty much just a casual drinker. I really didn't know what was going on back then, but later in life, I found out that my family, I was born into both sides of my family being extremely alcoholic and drug addicted. And so it did run in my family, but my dad was pretty functional, you know, he was high functioning, but also like I was always around cigarette smoke, you know, and the driving and all the long drives and long trips and long driving vacations. He was always smoking cigarettes in the house. So naturally I thought it was okay. So I started with that at 12 years old and started hanging out with the bad kids. And I didn't really see myself as a bad kid, but you know, I started getting into trouble right around that age too. It didn't stop with cigarettes. It just snowballed into bigger and other things. And partying on the weekends. And I started drinking alcohol on the weekends and, you know, smoking weed. And that was my thing. I was always the escape artist, I called myself. Always trying to escape reality so I could get into a state of bliss. And when I was alone, which was a lot of times, I would get into that state of euphoria and I would exercise my artistic ability, whether it be drawing or writing or poetry or skateboarding or doing BMX biking with friends and stuff. It was always something I always wanted to get creative when I would get into that state, but also started getting into a lot of trouble and hanging out with the wrong people and being associated with people who were always getting in trouble. And it was with the cops right away and in school. And yeah, it was a lot of trouble the whole time. I had a lot of behavior issues, and I'm not sure if it was exactly, you know, result of the drinking and drugs that I was doing, or if it was a lot of just angst that I was feeling, a lot of frustration. I felt a lot of frustration because I had zero control over my life. And my parents had all the control, and all the authority figures had all the control. And I was just like some pawn, you know, and I had a punk rock heart back then, you know. I was like one of the 90s kids that was coming up with a lot of angry music and a lot of reeling against the system kind of feelings and thoughts and developing those kinds of morals from a young age was always like based in anger. Even though I was like really fun loving and life of the party for the most part and really lighthearted and always making jokes and having fun, being the class clown, there was always this like this undercurrent of it's coming from a place of anger. And also, you know, thinking back on it now, you know, I have a lot of distance between now and then. Thinking back on it now, it was a whole lot of fear as well. So I was lashing out all the time with bad behaviors because I was fearful of the changes that I didn't see coming. I was angry about those changes because I had no power or control over those changes. And, you know, I drank about it and I smoked weed about it and I got in trouble. School was really hard for me because there was a lot of rules and I hated rules. And I wanted to break them and bend them as much as I could to my will so that I can get what I want. So I can feel like maybe I'm justified in my actions. And I learned that at such a young age, and it really was just work to my detriment. The in-school suspensions, out-of-school suspensions, after-school detention, Saturday detentions, summer school, all this stuff, like it was just completely, you know, I was completely not okay. for a very, very long time. And I was so unruly that at the age of 17, after another move to another school system, to another house with another stepmom, I was so ill-mannered and bad behaved that my dad said it was that he was going to kick me out at 18 when I turned 18. And he stuck to it. And I begged him not to. And I knew that I was in such fear that I was willing to do anything to stay, but he just had it. And I can understand a certain part of that back then, like his marriage was basically on the line because of my terrible behavior and the consequences that I was facing and all the trouble that I was bringing to his home. He really wanted to teach me through what he called tough love. There's consequences for my actions. And the consequences for all this, you know, culmination of actions was you can't live here anymore. And at this point at this time in my life, I look back on it like he did the right thing for himself and his wife. And I also have a certain amount of, you know, that was probably not what I needed back then. And I needed rehab. I needed healthy friends. I needed a father to support me and correct me when I'm doing wrong, or, you know, I really needed therapy. But dad was against therapy and he was just done. You know, he was done being my uncle said he was done being a father, and he hated my dad for that, but, you know, neither here nor there anymore. So at 18, I got kicked out of the house and my dad helped me move into an apartment. He paid my first month's rent and sent me on my way. And that began the year of hell, I call it. I was doing whatever I wanted to do because there were no rules. I had a awesome roommate, and she was also in the same kind of personality, definitely one of us. And we had a party house. You know, we had a two-bedroom apartment. We had parties all the time, on the weekends, on the weekdays, didn't matter. You know, whenever we wanted to drink, whenever we wanted to have a party, whenever we wanted to do drugs, we did it. You know, I got involved with this girl. About 6 months into the relationship, I realized that I really didn't want to be around her, and I broke up with her. And she came into a party about 5 or 6 months after that, and she told me that she was pregnant. And by the age of 19, I was a father. And I was not ready for that. I was completely beside myself. I thought that with all the drugs and alcohol that I was doing, that my kid would turn out to be some kind of just... that I had, you know, somehow damaged myself, and she was doing the same kinds of drugs too. I didn't think it was going to be healthy, but really I was just scared of taking responsibility for my actions. And I didn't see him for the first 4 years of his life. And I had a lot of shame and a lot of guilt, and I hid from the world a lot. And I experienced a lot of anxiety back then, and a lot of justified anger. And I lived in justified anger for a long time. I know now that that was what I needed to get through, but it was not fair for my son. And I could have done a lot of things differently. But when he was 4, I started taking responsibility for my life and my actions, and I started seeing him, and I became the weekend warrior dad, bringing him every other weekend or every weekend, and, you know, months at a time in the summer. And I'm drinking the whole time, and I'm hiding it from him as much as I possibly could, and not drinking and driving when I'm with him. But, you know, when I'm not with him, the brakes are off. And I was drinking and driving a lot back then. And at age 21, I got my first DUI. And I crashed my car, my first car. I was completely obliterated driving down the street. I'm surprised I wasn't blacked out. I actually remember the entire incident. I lost control of my vehicle out of nowhere for no apparent reason other than that I hit the gravel on the side of the road and I fishtailed off the road and I went off into a ditch and I hit the lawn so hard that it rolled the grass up like a rug and buried itself in my transmission and completely totaled my car. And, you know, I blew over and got sent to jail again. There's a lot of jail visits by this time in my life. But at this point, alcohol was the culprit. And I was sent to, like, I don't know, I was feeling like I was in denial. But the judges didn't see it that way. Suspended my license and sentenced me to go to 2 AA meetings a week for a year. And that was not my first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous, but it was my first time in Alcoholics Anonymous where I was supposed to be there. I was forced to be there and I'd hated every minute of it. And, you know, I would draw during the meetings and I was so disrespectful back then. I swear to God, it's looking back on that time is I feel some shame and guilt for putting people who were trying to get sober and trying to repair their lives and, you know, putting them in a room, like going into a room with them smelling of alcohol and being drunk in the meetings, drinking before the meetings. And I wouldn't always do that, but Alcoholics Anonymous made, like, all this talk about alcohol makes me want to drink is what I say. And so I'd go out and get drunk after the meetings. And there's no taking it seriously for me back then. I was in a complete state of denial, but I kept going to those meetings because I was on probation. If I didn't go to the meetings, then I would get in serious, serious trouble. And when that year was over, I continued on my merry way and didn't stop drinking. And I wasn't drinking and driving for a long time. You know, you get a lot of perspective over the years. And the perspective was that even though I wasn't listening and I wasn't agreeing and I wasn't looking at the steps seriously and I didn't know why I was there, especially like I could never be an alcoholic. This is not me kind of things. The seed was planted. Absolutely. Maybe there might be a possibility, some snowball's chance in hell that I'm an alcoholic, that I have a problem. And I had this chip on my shoulder where it just wouldn't allow me, my internal self wouldn't allow me to face reality. I did not want to face reality. You know, time goes on and time goes by and my 20s were a lot of the same, a lot of the same, except for I stopped getting into so much trouble when I was about between 24 and 30. I wasn't in much trouble back then. Maybe the occasional parking ticket or speeding ticket, but I wasn't. I had somewhat learned to not drink so much and get behind the wheel of a car. Not to say that I didn't learn my lesson, because I did continue and I did drink and drive at times where I knew I shouldn't. So fast forward to about 28 or 29 years old. I think it was 28. And that was around 2008 when the recession hit, and it hit the Midwest especially hard, very hard. I lost my job. My dad lost my job. My friends and family were losing their jobs and they were struggling to keep afloat and they were losing their houses and they were there was a lot of really dark times for a lot of us back then in the Midwest. And my dad lost his job and he couldn't find one. And I was on unemployment for like 2 years. And I was painting with my friend's painting company. I was doing whatever I could to stay afloat. My dad couldn't find a job to save his life. And, you know, we're going to all these employment job fairs, you know, and redoing our resume and taking resume classes. And we're talking about all of this. And my dad just like, I don't know, he had a really hard time with it. And he took it very personally that, you know, he couldn't support his wife. And, you know, I got a call at 28 years old from my aunt, and my aunt told me that my father killed himself and he committed suicide and he was gone. And that pretty much fractured me right down the middle and broke me. I was completely devastated. And, you know, suicide is a very unique loss. It is not your normal passing. It's jarring and it's shocking. And I was sent into a state of shock. I think back on it, like I was so shocked that I couldn't function. But at that time I knew I needed help for it because I was not functioning, and I had some healthy people around me, some very encouraging people around me, like my mom and my girlfriend. And I had, you know, two sons at this point. So my girlfriend had a son I was raising with her, and I had my son too. And I had two personalities at this time. On one side of the personality, I didn't want to be anything like my father, and I didn't want to end up like him. And I knew that if I continued going down the same road, then I would end up like him. And I didn't want that for myself. And I wanted to go to college and I wanted to do right for myself. And I wanted to be able to support myself and a family and show my son that this is what a father does. And then on the other side, I wanted to say, fuck it all. Fuck you. Fuck me. Fuck everything. I hate you. I hate life. Everybody's against me. You're an asshole. And it was just so toxic. And I would have these mood swings between, you know, fuck it all and I want to be a good person. But I wasn't always in that horrible state of mind. I did a lot of good things for myself and back then, and ended up going to college for filmmaking and art. And, you know, I started going to suicide loss support groups, and I was going regularly. I was seeing a shrink. Well, I would say therapist. I wouldn't say shrink. That's kind of detrimental, but I was seeking help and I needed help. I needed a lot of help back then. And I got a lot of help back then. Reading inspirational books, and I was going to these help meetings, and I was seeking God, and I was praying, and I was meditating and reading books by authors like Wayne Dyer, and learning a lot about Taoism back then and spirituality. And it all might have worked if I could stop drinking, but I couldn't stop drinking. Or maybe I just didn't stop drinking, I think is the thing. It was definitely something that I wanted to do back then, even though I, in the face of such consequences and terror and just the worst kind of depression I've ever experienced in my life, I kept pouring a central nervous depressant down my throat. And I was experiencing panic attacks. I was going to college and I had a lot on my plate and I was about to finish college. I was in my last semester of my filmmaking degree and it was a lot of oration involved. It was a lot of presentation and it was a lot of being on my feet 100% of the time, being 100, you know, being there and present and being creative. And that's who I wanted to be. I wanted to be a creative individual and I wanted to make a living doing it. That was really hard time for me because I was experiencing these panic attacks, which were just crippling. And I was like, I was on the other, every other day plan. I would drink to oblivion and I would black out and I would aim for blackouts and I would seriously do a lot of damage to myself and make an ass of myself and say a lot of stuff that I didn't mean. And it was just, I was in a horrible state of mind back then. And I was living with my mom yet again seeking solace from my parents. And so I learned how to ask for help when I really needed it. And my mom was just really upset at, you know, what was going on with me. And she would find me drunk in the car and in the morning and bringing all kinds of crazy people home and to her house. And I sought help for it because I wanted to finish my degree program and I couldn't function because I was just experiencing agoraphobia and just like this crippling anxiety. I didn't know why. And so I went to a doctor and I told him about the anxiety and they gave me a prescription for Xanax. And I brought it home and I started drinking with the Xanax and the blackouts were instantaneous. It got very dangerous very quickly. And everything was accelerated when I was mixing drugs with the alcohol like that. And my mom couldn't take it and she kicked me out. I grabbed all my stuff and I packed up my dad's car. I had inherited my dad's car. And in college, there was this professor. And at that time, I was in an internship program and I was asking him for advice and what I should do after college. And he's like, here's what I would recommend. And I was listening to him. He says, I recommend that if you're going to go and do something with your life, say like move to Hollywood or move to New York City or move to Chicago where the industries are, I would go out there beforehand, get your feet on the ground. Don't just go for a week, go for like a month, see what it's like. See, get in there and see if you like it because you may not. And I heard that. That was playing in the back of my head when I had my car full of all of my belongings. At one point, I had another choice, a big choice. It was like I was in Michigan and I was completely alone and I had my car and I was looking down the road, like facing south, looking east and looking west. And I'm thinking, I can go back to Cleveland and I can go back to my old life and I know it's going to be the same. And I was entirely fearful that I would end up like so many of my friends back then, where I would end up dead. The opiate crisis had hit the Midwest especially bad back then, and I lost like 6 friends in 3 months, and I was terrified of going back to the life that I had. So I picked west, and I headed west. Nothing really worked out for me the way that I wanted it to back then, I swear to God. I headed west and I hit Chicago and I stayed in Chicago for a little while. And then I headed up north to Wisconsin. And my goal was to take my dream road trip, was to drive across the country, see all the sights, go up to Washington State, hit the West Coast, and then drive all the way down the West Coast to Los Angeles and establish myself in Los Angeles and start my career as a filmmaker. And I got it as far as Wisconsin and my car broke down. And I was completely homeless for the first time in my life. I spent 2 weeks by the side of the river on the riverbank of the Wisconsin Dells River in Wisconsin Dells, Wisconsin. I had a sleeping bag, a duffel bag full of clothes, a backpack, and an electric guitar. I was completely devastated and I didn't know what to do with myself. I wanted to travel west, but I was completely stuck. And I went to this casino that I had been frequenting because I could go to the casino, it was open all night, and I could bum cigarettes off of people and get free coffee and stuff like that. And sat down next to this guy named Jamie, and Jamie was playing roulette and we started shooting the shit. And I told him, for some reason I opened up to him because I was completely vulnerable and I opened up to him and I let him know my situation, that my car broke down. I'm trying to get to Los Angeles and I don't have a ride. I swear, you know, my prayers were answered in that moment. When Jamie told me what he did for a living, and what Jamie did for a living is that he flew into a major city and he grabbed a vehicle for a new owner, and he would drive that vehicle all the way across the country to its new owner. Jamie had flown into Detroit and picked up a BMW X5 and had driven it up into Wisconsin and stopped off for some gambling for a moment. And then he was traveling west to Washington State, of all places, to Bainbridge to hand the BMW over to his new client. And I said, and he said, you know, it gets really lonely on the road. I'd like to, you know, have some company. Would you like to share the driving? And I'm like, absolutely. I don't know. And it felt like kinsmen. It felt like a miracle had happened in my life. And we got into the, you know, we drove over to the side of the river and grabbed my belongings, my backpack, my duffel bag, my sleeping bag, and my electric guitar. And off we went. And I got to do the trip that I wanted to do for all that time. And we got to share the driving and drive up through Montana and through Washington State and drive up the coast and get up to Bainbridge. And I saw the Pacific Ocean for the first time. And I just fell in love. I just fell in love. I loved the smell. I had missed the ocean for so long. I was always drawn to the West Coast, even the, you know, just from movies and TV and my childhood and stuff. I had dreamed from a little kid of going west and moving to Hollywood and moving to California, becoming a movie star and becoming a Disney animator, or, you know, becoming, you know, the next great director or the, you know, great actor. So I always dreamed of this stuff. And at that point, I think I saw like a lot of possibilities happen when I saw the Pacific Ocean. I'm like, okay, I'm going to keep going. I'm going to keep going. I have some hope about me now. And, you know, I got on the phone with my mom, called mom yet again, and asked my mom for a bus ticket to Los Angeles. And she said, Jared, this is the last time I'm going to help you. And I said, okay, mom. And she said, no, Jared, this is the last time I'm going to help you. And she meant it. And I said, okay. And I got on that Greyhound bus and I took it down to Los Angeles. I got off the bus and a very unsavory part of Los Angeles where the bus station is. And I was homeless. And I had my backpack, my duffel bag, and a sleeping bag, and my electric guitar. And I bummed a cigarette off this dude. And he's like, I see your situation here. You got place to stay? I said, no, I don't know where to go. He's like, all right, well, most people go to Venice Beach when they're in this kind of situation that you're in. I think you should get on this bus and go out to Venice Beach. And I did it. And I went out to Venice Beach and I parked myself on the beach, and I was homeless on the beach in Venice Beach. And I was homeless and hopeless in Venice Beach for a good long time. And I experienced what it was like to be very hungry and experience what it's like to be in the darkest state of depression in the most beautiful place that I've ever seen in my life. And completely powerless, being stripped of my possessions, I was immediately thrust into the world of the homeless Los Angeles and riding the beach, I call it. There's nothing but unsavory people on the beach when they're homeless. Like, I could not find a good person to save my life. And I didn't know what to do. So I just kind of fell in with those people. But I didn't want to be like those people. And then I saw myself becoming like those people, and I really didn't like what I was saw. I did not like myself. And I met this guy over in, I went out to Hollywood. I got my feet on the ground, like my professor had recommended, and you know, it was, I knew that I could maybe do what I set out to do and have a career in the film industry if I could get off the streets. I didn't really put two and two together back then because I was completely out of my mind. But I went to this church in Hollywood called Hope. And Hope would feed the homeless twice a day, hot meals at 10 and 4. And so I started frequenting that church, and they had meetings there, and they had services there. And I would go to the services and started meeting some people who were actually good people. And they started talking about God. And I was so vulnerable back then. I was listening, and I was hearing what they had to say. And I was watching these beautiful people have awesome lives and be completely happy and joyous and free. And I really wanted that. And I didn't know how to get myself out of my situation. I was coming home to Marina Del Rey Beach one night after a really hard loss of getting robbed again, losing my driver's license, my birth certificate and social security card all in the same robbery. And I was completely at my lowest, emotionally, spiritually, physically, probably starving to death. And I'm dragging this formerly rolling suitcase down the street. It had broken the wheels. The wheels literally fell off. And I'm dragging this suitcase down the sidewalk to go sleep on the beach in Marina Del Rey. And this guy comes up to me, and he's got a pink box of donuts in his hands. And he said, "Hey, man, hey, you look hungry, man. Do you want a donut?" And he opens his box. I'm like, "Yeah, I'll take a donut. Thanks." And I grabbed my donut, and he said, "You know, you look really hungry. Here, have the whole box. Have the whole box." And I'm like, no, thanks. So I'll just take what I need. Give it to somebody else, please. And he said, "Hey, can I talk to you for a second?" And I said, "Absolutely." And he told me, I used to be exactly where you are 3 years ago. He says, "I came out here on a wing and a prayer, and I couldn't get off the beach to save my life. And I couldn't stop drinking." And he told me, "You don't have to live this way anymore. There is a better way to live." And he told me about Alcoholics Anonymous again. He told me, I got sober, and I got off the streets, and I started doing right for myself, and things changed. And I've been off the streets I've been sober for 3 years, and you can do it too. That was another point where I was listening. I was completely at my lowest, and I was listening, and I heard him. And I said, "Thank you." And we parted ways, and, you know, slept on the beach again. And I got up the next morning looking at the most beautiful place I'd ever seen in my life. And I had an inkling that maybe drugs and alcohol were a big problem for me, that maybe if I got sober, I could be successful and have the life that I wanted to lead. I could be the man that I had set out to be, and I could succeed. And so I went back to that church and I asked for help, and they didn't let me in right away, because they see a lot of homeless people cross their paths. And what I knew about Hope was that they did take people in off the streets, and they had a sober program going there. And they would not take me in unless I was sober, and I couldn't commit right away, but I came back again, and I asked for help again. I said, "I'm sober. I'm not drinking." And so Pastor Ed was an amazing guy back then. He let me in after letting me sleep on the stoop of the steps outside the church. I'm pretty sure he just wanted to see if I was serious. And I was. I stayed sober for that. I don't remember how many days I was out there on the stoop of the steps of the church, but I was safe. And, you know, I was sleeping one morning, sleeping out there one morning, and one of the guys woke me up. He said, "Hey man, hey, come on in. You want to help with the breakfast this morning?" And he brought me into the church, and then I was on the other side of the plate, and I was the one being of service for the first time in ever. And they had a bed for me, and they got me off the streets, and I got sober. And there's a long story after that. I didn't stay sober for my first sobriety stint. My original sobriety date is November 17th, 2013. And I haven't had a drop of alcohol since, but I did have a slip in 2015, which led me down the same path, down the same road. And I will say it now, and I'll say it again, that the same thing happened again. I ended up in the same place again after rebuilding my life and being sober for a long time, because I wasn't paying attention to my peripherals. I was blindsided by an illness that wants me dead. And I got sober again in 2016, and it was not easy. It was really hard to come back from burning my life to the ground within a month again. But I did. And I ended up in Long Beach, California, where there's a really good network of meetings and a really good amount of sobriety. A lot of people who really care about other people, and they really care about what doing the deal means. And doing the deal for me means I go to a lot of meetings, I help a lot of people, and I stay sober. I practice the principles in all my affairs. And I've been living in Long Beach ever since 2016, and my life has gotten progressively better, and it just kept getting better and better. And just when I don't think it can get any better, it gets better. You know, I have now everything that I prayed for when I was homeless and hopeless. I prayed for years for the life that I have today. And, you know, I practice the maintenance steps regularly every morning. I wake up in prayer, and I read some inspirational materials, and I send it out to about 12 guys and touch base with my sponsor is one of those first thing in the morning. And I do 10 minutes of meditation, and then I'm out for the day. And then I'm praying all throughout the day when I need to, and when I feel like it's the time to. And then I go to a meeting in the evening. I don't go to a meeting every day, but I go to enough meetings throughout the week. And I, you know, I'm busy with AA 5 days a week. I have two sponsees that I watch their lives change. And I can't be any more proud of my sponsees than I am today, because they're doing the work and they inspire me to do the work. And it becomes a progressive, positive paradox that we keep doing the same thing. We keep helping ourselves. We keep helping each other, which helps ourselves. And we're trying to be the good people that we want to be. We're trying to live up to the spiritual principles that have been set before us. Today, I have the self-esteem that I always wished I had. I have a sense of confidence and a God of my understanding that I can have faith in times of trouble. And I can be the son that I need to be, and the brother that I need to be, and the father that I need to be. And that's all I have for tonight. Thank you.
Thank you, Jared. Thank you for your story. And I'm not sure what it was about your story that filled my heart with such gratitude that I get to do this service work and hear somebody go from homelessness to a life of peace and joy and serenity. I was going to ask you, when you met Jamie in the casino, if there were other prayers that had been answered over the years. And it sounds like your entire life is your prayers answered? What in your life today is specifically things you longed for and prayed for over the years?
That's a great question. Well, I was talking to my friend Chris, who was an alcoholic, and he was doing the deal, and he said, you just want the good life. You just want to live in the Hollywood Hills, and you want to have all the fancy cars, and you want to have the life that you always dreamed of. And I said, no, that's not what I want anymore. He said, it might have been what I wanted before, but what I want now is I want to live a decent life. And today, the things that I have now that I prayed for before is I have a decent job. I get paid very well for doing an interesting career. I actually became a published author. I wrote 4 books so far in this sci-fi series that I write, and I'm self-published on Amazon. And, you know, I exercise my creativity to get closer to my higher power. That's an interesting paradox in itself, too, because I don't know if I ever dreamed of being an author, but I definitely dreamed of fulfilling my creative desires. And that's something that prayers answered. I mean, I've been able to see something to completion. I'm able to see things to completion these days, and I'm able to keep my mind open enough to learn new things. I have a very healthy relationship with my son today, and my mom. And even though we have, 3,000 miles of separation between us, we're still very close, and I have a stable job, a stable home, and a career that I can be proud of. And those things I prayed for years, I'm just so grateful for all those things.
I've said before, when I would drink, it just felt like I was connecting to source. Before it got dark, I would drink and I would feel closer to God. And I would also try to write. And I would say things smell different when I've had a few drinks. Like you go to a different place and you travel. And you alluded to that just now, or you outright said, like, you use your creativity to get closer to your higher power. Do you have a similar experience? Because you talked about you didn't say what drugs, but you were talking about alcohol and drinking and how you would be in this quote unquote state of bliss and you would be creative in whatever, skateboarding or drawing or whatever you were doing. Is there some relationship for you two between escaping self and higher power and connection and source and creativity?
Oh, absolutely. And I saw that when I got sober. I didn't see that as that was what I was doing before I got sober. But that was something that was revealed to me when I got sober, and I knew I wanted to do something creative, but I was really afraid to be creative. But then I started having some faith, and it started coming out, and it came out in the form of words. And that's like, I use meditation to get me into that state of mind. And that's the healthy way to the creative power is through meditation. And that's what I have found, that the connection that I have with my higher power, it fills me with inspiration at the most weirdest times. It seems like I can attain that through healthy means, in which, the unhealthy means, I could attain that state of mind through unhealthy means, like, cocaine and ecstasy and acid and mushrooms and all the things that I used to do. But I was just so happy. I mean, filled with complete joy that I can still exercise my creative muscles without having to drink or drug.
Well, I appreciate the the avenue there is meditation. What a blessing it is to still be able to be creative without creating all that damage. So thank you for that. You made a comment early on when your mom moved and took your sister And you moved in with your dad, I guess, in his hometown in Pennsylvania, if I got that right.
In Cleveland, yeah.
Okay. And so you said, instead of I moved in with my dad, you said your mom gave you to your father. Do you feel like she left you?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, I found out years down the road that, you know, my mom didn't exactly want a son. She wanted a daughter. And yeah, she definitely, I felt a lot of abandonment from a very young age. And I tried to have a relationship with her, and I sought her out for years and years. And she didn't start drinking until she was 31. But when she started drinking, the wheels came off right away. And so I went to Al-Anon, and I started practicing the principles of Al-Anon in my life. And those principles helped me come to terms with the abandonment issues. You know, I'm reading an inspirational book from an Al-Anon, it's an Al-Anon daily reader. And those principles are helping me with all of the stuff that, that Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't entirely address, more so the emotional sobriety parts. And, you know, we get physically sober, we get spiritually sober, but the thing that we need to maintain on top of all of this is our emotional sobriety. There came a point in time where I realized that my mother didn't have the love that I've sought, and I had to cut her out of my life. And I had to stop taking her calls and texts because she was just so relentless about calling me when she was drunk. And, you know, that was a really hard loss for me. And I've tried to open the door a couple of times through letters to her. And, you know, I know that I can't have a relationship with her if she's not sober. And, that's hard to come to terms with, you know. And But the thing about it that I do have in my life is my stepmom. And my stepmom has been mom since 3 years old for me. She's been mom, you know, and she's been there for me ever since. All throughout the year, she's been there for me, and she's still there for me as mom. And that's just my truth. And I don't have any ill will towards my biological mother, and I love her very much. And, you know, I just have two moms, you know, and I'm actually very fortunate to have, you know, the mothers that I have in my life.
That's very sweet. That's very sweet. So when you say you have healthy relationships with your son and your mom, you mean your stepmom?
Yeah, my stepmom.
That's so sweet. And the Al-Anon program, combining it with AA, and when you were still drinking, I mean, you're really like, you had suicide support groups and you had a therapist and you were seeking help and God and all this stuff. And it sounds like you're still doing these things where you're going to Al-Anon and you're going to AA and you're doing what you need to do and you're remaining creative. And I admire all of that effort. You did make one comment. You said, I couldn't stop drinking, or I didn't stop. It was right at that same time when you were talking about these suicide loss support groups and therapists and whatnot. It would have all worked, except you couldn't stop drinking or you didn't stop. Do you not know, or do you think now if you went back that you could have stopped and that you just didn't?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and it's pretty controversial. I don't have like a very traditional sense of, you know, what Alcoholics Anonymous says in their meetings. And I feel a little bit, let me see how to put it. So the thing about it is that I didn't stop drinking until I did stop drinking. I had a lot of windows of opportunity to stop drinking, but I chose to keep drinking. And I didn't know that there was a solution on the other side of the decision to stop drinking. So I was in fear of what my life would be like if I did stop drinking. Until I saw that solution, I didn't stop drinking. The lights didn't come on until the lights came on. And that's the thing. Like, I did make a decision to stop drinking. And that's what the fact of the matter is. Like, the fact remains, I stopped drinking. Or it's kind of confusing, right? Because I also feel like my higher power put me in a position that I really had no other choice but to stop drinking. So it is a little bit confusing, but you know, it's hard to put my finger on exactly how I feel about that. So yeah.
I've asked myself the same question a million times. So I think it's the chicken or the egg a little bit, because
yeah.
Like you, I stopped drinking 2 years before my sobriety date. So my last drink was longer than how long I've been sober. And I remember specifically making a decision at my sobriety date that I just wanted, I made an active decision. But did I get myself to the point where I was ready to make the decision, or did circumstances in life and God get me to experience certain things to where I finally waved my white flag and said, okay, I'm done. I don't know.
Right.
And I think that for you, having been a suspended license and probation, and you were sent to meetings for a year, and you were the snotty brat showing up, you had mentioned having shame and remorse. And my thought is, there is no reason you should have shame and remorse. If we believe that everybody's on their journey, you were in the right meeting at the right time, and everybody there experiencing you needed that for their journey as well. So there's no reason for shame and remorse. That's what I like to believe. Because I've seen those guys in meetings, and in my early days, it's really easy, and girls, it's really easy to say, that's not what I want.
Yeah, we see them all the time coming into the rooms, and it's, you know, they say, but for the grace of God, there go I, you know, I'm not sure if I subscribe to that saying. I'm not sure if I understand that saying, but I relate to those people like, oh my God, that was me.
Yeah. And I feel like if we're really practicing the principles in all of our affairs, every single alcoholic experiencing that person on probation coming into the rooms drunk should be met with love and tolerance. Like, tolerance and acceptance is our code. And that's what we do. And this is the safe place to go. And so there should be nobody should be digesting you as being disrespectful, as you described yourself.
Right.
Not in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, not in the rooms I go to. There's so many different meetings, but I like to go to the meetings where we are tolerant and loving, even when it's hard. We do ask that you not talk if you're drunk, but I mean, that's just fair. Anyways, I'm so sorry for your father and the suicide. And I was 28 when my mother did the same thing. It just took 6 months for her body to let go. And it's just tragic. And I'm so sorry.
Yeah, I'm sorry too. It's a very unique pain, and I relate to anybody who is going through this. And the thing about the suicide is that I learned from it. I had the experience, and that experience is just like all of my drinking experience. I can use that experience to help other people who are going through the same thing. Yeah. And God put somebody in my life that happened to very recently. He lost his dad in the same way. And I know what to do in that situation. I know that I got to communicate that my door is open to that person, that I have had the same experience that they have. And I know how unique that pain is. So if you have any questions, you need anything, you need to talk it out, you need to rant and rave, I'm here. Here's my phone number.
For some reason, that reminded me of when somebody donates their body after they pass. You know, it's like such a loss, but at least the parts can help others. You know, like we have this terrible loss, but at least we could share our getting, you know, we're on the other side of it, so we can then use our experience to help others.
Absolutely.
Is there anything in your story or anything not, and let me rephrase, let me start over, rewind. Jared, is there anything that you did not share or that you're thinking of now that you would like to share?
I'm just so grateful for the opportunity to have a clear and open mind and be able to communicate a message of hope to others. That's really what I'm all about these days. Is I love people now more than I used to. And I care about everybody that I encounter. And I'm just so happy for this opportunity to be able to share a message of hope, because that's really what changed my life, is actually seeing that there was real hope in the world and that things do get better.
For more information, read the first 164 pages of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous or visit keepcomingback.net.